community radio stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, Melbourne's Joy 94.9.
This episode of Word for Word first went to air in August 2014. Hello and welcome to Word for Word. Dean Beck with you today. Thank you very much for joining me. And today's guest is a man who has inspired many, but his story is an inspiration in itself. He is a champion athlete and has managed to win just a few medals in the process, including a couple of Paralympian gold. It is my great pleasure to welcome Sam Bramman to the studio. Sam, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Dean. I'm still buzzing from that Rocky intro. That's what I used to think about in training.
I know. I read that you were a bit of a fan of the Rocky movies, and so I thought, I think you said you can't ever watch them enough or something, something to that effect.
Definitely the first couple. I think you got a bit elaborate old Sylvester Stallone with the last few, or the last 10, how many you've made.
I'd have to agree with you there. Sam, your story is a challenging one, but for some reason you just keep smiling and keep a good spirit. Why is that? Your parents, does that come from, or what is it about your cheery nature?
It's an amalgamation of a number of things. For me, it's never been a challenge. Mm-hmm. I've been quite lucky in the sense that my disability it's extremely manageable. I'm very independent. I don't have to rely on a carer or, you know, a mobility aid or anything like that that restricts me from doing a lot of things from day-to-day life. So in that aspect, I've been very, very lucky. But, yeah, my family have been very supportive, my friends, my coach. I've always surrounded myself with a different sort of eclectic bunch of people that give me something individually, which has helped me develop as well. But no, I've been very lucky.
You were born without a femur and a bit of a hip issue. Is that right?
And a fat head, apparently.
Well, you're not the only one to be born with a fat head. I can promise you that.
Well, yeah. So basically, the doctors didn't know that there was something different until I was actually, you know, breaching. I was coming out. Mm. They found that the right leg was shorter. So basically I was born without the femur, the longest bone in the body. So there's a shin bone resting in the hip socket with a small foot. Also, there was a few sort of hip deformities there, not the same sort of shape as a normal hip as your standard hip. So they did a few operations when I was about 5 years old. So they amputated the actual foot so I could use a prosthetic leg and pinned it into the prosthetic leg itself.
And the hip issue, which is kind of, that's pretty major and fixed. Was that corrected, or how did what happened with the way the hip was?
Well, the hip wasn't so much of a problem. It was more finding how the shin bone would rest in that hip socket, what was there.
Yep.
So they basically pinned it. So basically put a drill through the whole sort of joint, put a bolt through it so it just pivots and swings, just like as my left hip would, my femur into my left part of my hip. And that's pretty much what they did.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, so it wasn't too much of a struggle, I don't think.
Do you remember much about the time prior to your foot being amputated?
Not too much, because when I had my foot amputated, I was in hospital for, you know, a while in there. Mm. So when I think of my youth and my leg, it was hospital. I had a lot of fun in hospital, besides it was very painful and whatever, but lots of love, lots of support. Friends and family were in there the whole time. But pre-operation, not really. Mm. It was just a foot, really.
But you were active then, too.
Yeah, extremely. And it's funny, when I used to hate the water as a toddler. Absolutely hate it. So it's funny that I wanted to choose that as swimming as my pursuing career. But I used to, you know, be put on the side of the pool and walking around the side of the edges and screaming when someone tried to pull me in. After that, yeah, I definitely sort of kept running around the backyard or hobbling around the backyard with my pirate leg, basically. But yeah, very active.
So you had a prosthetic leg from an early age as well, or?
Yeah, I did. It wasn't what you'd call a sort of a typical prosthetic leg. So there was no knee joint. It was basically like a, you could almost get a PVC pipe and just whack the stump in. That's what it was like. Right. It didn't bend. There was a little rubber foot on it. My mum's actually
almost kept, like a crutch.
Yeah, essentially was.
Yeah, yeah.
But my mum's actually kept the first prosthetic leg that I ever have, like little baby foot on it.
Mums
and put it away.
Do that shit. Why they is do, that?
I have no idea. I find it insanely creepy. But and if you know, if you're moving houses and you leave prosthetic legs in a house, it's kind of spooky at the same time. But
so, tell us about having your leg chopped off, because that in itself was a bit of an ordeal with some rather bizarre outcomes initially.
Yeah, of course. So I was very lucky to have my leg amputated when I was 5. So I was still developing at that age a lot. So to have the leg amputated then, I wasn't getting used to having something else there.
That must have been scary, though, as a kid to face that.
A little bit. Like, I do remember mum and dad explaining as best they can to a 5-year-old that, look, there's going to be part of your body being chopped off. And in my mind, because I was born with that disability, I didn't see that as an issue or a problem or it being different or how it's going to hinder me in the future. But I remember just thinking, okay, well, mum and dad, they've normally been right. When I've done something bad, they've corrected me. So this has to be right.
And they would have enrolled you in the possibility of a more functional leg and all that sort of stuff too, I would imagine.
Yeah, completely. Yeah. And I remember them showing me photos and, you know, things like that. But I knew that it had to be done just because they kept reiterating. And in hindsight, it was the best thing that we did because if the issues that came out. So once I had the leg amputated, the pain was immense, just like any operation. It's all, you can't compare it, but I can say it was painful. The healing process, you know.
Well, that's one of the things I want to touch on, if I may be so bold.
Yeah.
The itching you said you wouldn't wish upon anyone.
It was the phantom itching.
Phantom itching.
So
explain that.
So the phantom itching is basically your mind gets used to your body parts being there. When they amputate part of the body, it takes the mind a certain amount of time to adjust to the fact that it's no longer there. I was, at that age, I was lucky enough just to have a mosquito bite that, you know, I'd get before I had the leg amputated. When I had the leg amputated, my brain would trick me into thinking that I had a mosquito bite had bit me. So I'm trying to scratch it, but I can't get there because there's nothing there. So it's frustrating, really, really frustrating. But that's why I was lucky to have it amputated when I was 5. It took me a short time to get over that. For people later on in life, you know, when they're 25, 30 plus, and you have a limb amputated, the itching and the pain, it's just crazy.
And they still think that they can wiggle their toes sort of thing and stuff like that.
Yeah. It's some deep stuff. cerebral processes.
It sure is. So what did that mean for you going to school then? How did that play out?
Well, at 5, it was great because I missed out on class and stuff like that. I got to spend more time at home and, you know, lots of family members came around, bought me toys. So I was loving the attention. But I did start to miss school. I did start to miss my friends because I started off at school in the wheelchair and I knew some of the kids going into the school already. So I wanted to be part of all of that. So I started off my first time at school in the chair itself. The worry for my parents would have been immense. You know, what is he going to do? Is he going to hurt himself? Is he going to fall out of his chair? I just wanted to get in there and zip around in the chair with my friends. And I was lucky enough to have my friends that would want to take turns at pushing me around and include me in some way.
But kids can be pretty nasty too, and particularly if someone's different. Did you cop any of that?
I did, yeah. So I was about 8 years old, and not much. I was never bullied to the point where I was just so insecure. I know a lot of people that have. It's a sad thing. It's always going to happen. But, yeah, kids can be cruel. I knew that I could probably be cruel at sometimes when I was a kid. But you just you learn to understand these things. I remember one time I was 8 years old. This was after the operation, of course, had a prosthetic leg, playing footy with some of the guys, and I knocked a guy with the leg, and he turned around and said, "That hurt, you one-legged faggot." Now, and I know that you must hate to hear that word on this station. Now, I was 8 years, and I hate that word as well.
I did read this in the book, and did a double take. Explain further.
Well, so what happened was this guy turned around and said, "That hurt, you one-legged faggot." Now, I knew that I had one leg. That's descriptive. I get that part. That's not offensive. But I didn't know what a faggot was. So I remember going home to Dad and I said, "Dad, a guy at school..." No, I said, "Dad, what's a faggot?" And he said, "Why?" I said, "A guy at school called me a one-legged faggot." Now, it would have been hard for Dad trying to tell his 8-year-old son about the fact that he's just been bullied. You know, that faggot is a derogatory term for someone that likes someone of the same sex, that you should never call someone that and you shouldn't be offended by it either. So it must have been confusing for him.
Sure.
Then I went back to school and someone else must have heard him and someone else called me that. But it was at that point where I thought, hang on, there's nothing wrong with having one leg. There's nothing wrong with being gay either. So this guy must be feeling something, you know, pretty bad, pretty dark to feel the need to put someone down, to use these terms to put someone down. He's the one with the problem, not me. So I was lucky to learn that at a young age. And that's what I try and teach younger kids who are being bullied now, whether it's cyberbullying in the playground, even with professionals in the workplace, happens everywhere. It's about resilience. Be strong. I know it must suck, especially if it's a group thing. But just find out that and know that they're the ones with the problems, that they need to, you know, they're the ones with issues that need to be addressed. Just be strong, ignore it. There's nothing wrong with you. If they're going to continue on that sort of behavior, it's going to be a hard life for them.
So what was it that you were sporting, that's for sure, but what was it that you sort of gravitated towards if it wasn't swimming? What would you have been doing?
Water polo, definitely. I'll say it right now. If water polo was a Paralympic sport, I'd be all over it. There was actually a story.
You had some drama with that, didn't you?
So one of the rules in water polo is that you can't have 2 feet on the ground. You can have one on the ground. That's okay when you're resting. But if the referee sees you with two, they'll blow the whistle. You'd be subbed out. And I was in grade six, actually. We're playing school water polo. And the referee blew the whistle at me, said 2 feet on the ground. My sports teacher, Mr. O'Toole, came running around saying, no, crap, crap, crap. He's only got one bloody leg. And the referee, he was pretty embarrassed, so I got off it. So there's a perk of having one leg, I guess. But yeah, look, if water polo was a sport, I'd be doing it. The reason why I gravitated towards swimming, I was doing all the rugby and the footy and running around, but I couldn't keep up. Essentially, we're land animals, so to be able to lug a prosthetic leg around, there's a huge discrepancy, a disadvantage there when it comes to speed, mobility. So I couldn't keep up. And then I found swimming, which is a more, you know, upper body dominated sport. Use your arms more so than your legs. Enjoyed it. But best of all, I was finally beating my mates at something. So I thought, Rupert, this is where we're going to go, I think.
In fact, your training partner says you can keep up with the best of them.
Well, with him, yeah, Nick Horner, I couldn't keep up with him. He was fast, but some of them, a lot of them, yeah, absolutely.
Sam Bremen is my guest. Dean Beck with you today. And Sam is just as renowned for his exploits away from the swimming pool as he is in it. Have you always been a cheeky bugger?
I think so. So I've been told. As far as I can remember, yeah. I just seem to gravitate towards the troubling side of things, which I find invigorating, so to speak.
Was it a strong suit of yours to get through school to laugh things off and be the funny guy?
Yeah, I think looking back on it, and this is where the writing process was extremely profound, because I was revisiting memories and asking myself questions just like that one. Mm. You know, did I use humour to alleviate a lot of situations, awkward ones, things with my disability? 100%, yeah. From a young age, I've always liked to laugh. You know, both of my parents are incredibly funny, so they fostered that.
Right.
I've got very funny family members as well, funny in their own way.
Your grandfather seemed like a funny fellow too in his own way.
Absolutely. Yeah. He was dry, extremely dry, but I loved his sarcasm about things. Highly intelligent. So he taught me a sort of side of comedy which was different from what I got from Dad, what I got from Mum, from my uncle, from my cousins. So I got this mixed bag, and that's sort of where it grew from there. Going to school, definitely using humour helped. Subconsciously, I was sort of aware of the fact that I had one leg, even though it wasn't an issue for me. But I knew to distract people from it, yeah, I had it to be funny. Mm. If I could even use that leg, and it was ironic that I used the leg to be funny, to distract people from it. But I wanted people to look at the humour, look at the funny, and that's what I've sort of been branded with now.
Do you think, tell me what your thoughts are on Adam Hills' show, The Last Leg, and again, using humour in a space of disability to connect, I guess, all of us in a way that breaks down those barriers?
Absolutely. I think this is my personal opinion. I think we are pretty sensitive these days, and there's a lot of political correctness going around, which in the right forums, you need it. It's great. You have to lead by example. But
Do you think we're too sensitive sometimes?
I think we are, yeah. My personal opinion, especially when it comes to things like disability, especially when we're dealing with obesity. I think we're approaching these things with such lightness and we're treading on thin ice. Just be blunt up and straight up, and let's address it as it is. Like, people would come up and go, oh, so when you were born differently, what was that? Just say you were born with a disability. Just say it straight up. It's not, don't be sensitive about it. Same with political correctness. You know, we'd be in the workplace and someone would go, that person with disability. You can't say that anymore. You have to say with disabilities, because it's almost ignorant to think that there might only be one disability there. It's like, come on, like, what are we fine chopping things down for? Just call a spade a spade. I understand that I've got pretty thick skin, other people don't, but
sure.
The more sensitive we're going to be, and it's just more soft tissue around people. So, look, the shows like that, it does break down that stigma, and I think the more that it's out there and the more we speak about it comfortably and foster a sort of a comfortable environment to talk about it too, it stops people from asking questions, you know, what was it like, you know, to have sex without your leg, or, you know, what does it feel like to have one leg? What do people in wheelchairs experience? You know, what was it like to come out as gay, example? Like, all these things, if we have conversations with people and let people know this is what it was like, they're not going to have to ask that later on in life because they've got that basic understanding.
Yeah, you're right. I guess, how do you put that into context when you're speaking to young kids where where the nuances of political correctness and what's right and what's wrong aren't so defined, and you don't want to, you know, suggest something to a kid that then sends them off on the wrong track and upends their, you know, rest of their life.
Absolutely.
Because this guy came to talk to us and he had one leg.
And I can't exactly go to a group of year fives and go, oh, who wants to ask me about how my first experience with sex? Who wants it without my leg? Yeah, it's a bit inappropriate. But no, look, I think kids are curious by nature, more curious than adults. I think that curiosity should be rewarded at that young age. So educating the best we can about it, of course, to the right audience, to the right age. And then I think through, you know, political correctness, learning the correct terms and things like that, that will develop through school, through health and PE, through those sorts of things, couch with that knowledge, that one-on-one sort of first-hand experience too. I think they will learn that. But yeah, definitely you have to be carefully when educating the youth or talking to the youth.
You're just as good on one leg as you are on two.
In what sense?
Well, in the sense of getting around. I mean, yeah, in your, I guess it's off, but your balance in that is extraordinary.
Yeah, well, it's took me 26 years actually now to get used to balancing on one leg, so you'd hope that I'd be pretty good at it. But it's funny, with every new leg, you do get the hang of it. So you learn how it swings, how fast it goes through, the comfortability of it, the socket, height.
So do you, let's get down to nitty gritty.
Yeah, please.
Do you have to throw your leg? Is that how it works? Like with your knee, do you throw it forward, or how does that work?
With the first prosthetic legs that I had straight after the amputation when I was five, they were basically just a socket on a knee on a door hinge, swinging door hinge, yeah, with a pole with a leg. That's all it was. They've now advanced from there to a mechanical knee joint, to a hydraulic knee joint. There's even electrical prosthetic legs where even the toes move. They're really creepy. I don't want that. But the one that I'm using right now, it's a hydraulic knee pump. There's a computer chip down in the foot. If I step off on my left leg, the normal leg, I spend more time on that computer chip. It will read the timing through the step. It will pump hydraulic fluid into the knee or pump it out to make it swing through faster or swing through slower, depending how fast I want to walk.
Wow.
It's quite incredible. Now, that's a $35,000 prosthetic leg.
Right.
There's legs that go up to $100,000. That's
the
a lot of
wiggling toes.
The wiggling toe. That's when, and the fake hair is coming off.
Oh, no.
I don't know the word for it. There's one. It's the same thing. You know when you walk past a shop and you see a mannequin that looks real but not real enough.
It's that awkward sort of thing in between. It's not quite right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's the same when they do prosthetic legs. If they try and make it look real, you look at it, you do the double take, and it gives you this weird feeling.
And is that why you choose to wear a leg that looks like a prosthetic leg? I mean, it's not a stylized muscle and bone and all of that. It's kind of more an industrial look.
I think so. Thank you. That's what I was going for. Spot on. Thank you for complimenting. The prosthetic leg that I'm using now, so it's all carbon fiber. So it's generation 2 leg. It's extremely lightweight, lighter weight than the plaster previous models.
Well, I was going to ask you about that too, because it can't be too light, can it? Because it would throw your balance off, wouldn't it? Or not?
Not really. The knee joint and the mechanical components are quite weighty, but I don't have the same amount of muscle in my stump than I do in my left leg, so it needs to be lighter. So this leg, basically what they said, they go, yep, carbon fiber model, we'll wrap, you know, synthetic skin around it, and I'm going, no, I need it for functionality. I need to walk, I need to go hiking, I need to go rock. Like,
do those things become things that you then have to look after and care for, like the synthetic skin and all of that? Do they get damaged easily?
Yeah, absolutely. And right. So it just adds more drama. So, you know, you add more
and
things
weight
to it. Yeah, and more weight. It's like, you know, you get the brand new sort of laptop or the brand new television system. There's more things to go wrong.
Yeah.
So it's fine. I'll come back to the leg thing in a sec. But so this leg, basically, it's all carbon fiber, extremely lightweight, serves its purpose. That's all I need it to do. before this leg, it was the plaster leg, and they said, we can put the synthetic skin over it. No, I want the kangaroo flag on it. What I wanted originally was to get like a big picture of a penis to go around the side of it and hang out the bottom of the shorts. But my prosthetist sort of looked at me and said, yeah, that's not happening. People know that you get the legs made here. That's not really good branding. So, yeah, basically you go into the leg shop, they take a mold, get the socket, carbon fiber, then they pick which knee you want. So they basically give you catalogs. What knee would you like? So, like,
and
a car.
You have quite a relationship with your leg artist.
Yeah, it is art. It's absolute art. Yeah, Rex, and I've never known his last name, but he's been with me my whole life. He sits down in front of me, tinkers with the knee joint, and I just see his baldy little spotty head and his beard, and he's just manky, and I think he's got a drinking problem because he's bad breath all the time and sometimes stumbles around.
But he makes a good leg.
He makes a ripper leg, so maybe he's just a high functioning, but the leg, it is art. It's such art, so you have to mold it. And at the back of the socket, it's not just making a cup to plug your stump in, so to speak. It's that you need to mold a seat on the back so your bum rests on top of that so you can actually seat, so it takes off the weight bearing at the bottom of the stump so your bone doesn't push through the skin. There's so many factors that goes into these things, and this guy's nails it.
Wow. Okay, so then when you we haven't even got to your sport yet, you are looking at different sorts of athletic legs with your running and things now, with as you're heading towards other things, and we'll get to that. Is that a total re-engineering? You know, like a blade, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So the running leg, which I'll be using, it's the same suction cup which I would have at the top of this.
Yep.
It'll be much thinner, not built for comfort, so there won't be any seat on the back of it.
So you've got to keep moving, sort of thing.
Yeah, it's to walk on these things, it's extremely awkward. It goes down into a knee joint, which is called a Hosmer 4-bar. So it's a bar which is spring-loaded, so it just snaps forward after every run, so it can keep up with the speed of my left leg.
Yeah.
And then that's attached to a carbon fiber blade. It looks like a big J, black J.
Sure.
And when you land on that, that compresses and it springs me forward and it replicates exactly what my left leg done. And we've seen a photo of these blades most recently on television with our mate Oscar Pistorius, who likes shooting things, but that's what it is.
And it doesn't give you any greater advantage than the leg you already have. The action is still the same because it looks like it does spring you forward, but what we don't see is your real leg, it does the same thing, but it does do the same thing.
The only difference is, and this is as close as they can do as replicating the motions of a left leg or an able-bodied leg, a real leg, whatever you want to call it. So for the prosthetic leg, the only difference is I don't fatigue in it. I don't build up lactic acid.
Right.
Now, this was the big argument.
Of course.
Yeah, and this was the big argument with Oscar Pistorius when he wanted to run in the Olympics because he was fast enough. The International Paralympic Committee was saying, no, this is our reason why you can't, is because these guys, these runners, they run with their real legs. You're using fake legs. They don't build up lactic acid. You've got a benefit there. And the more you run on these things, you'll pick up more and more and more and more speed. So it was unfair. Not only that, he pretty much slapped a lot of the other athletic guys in the face by saying, no, the Paralympics isn't good enough. I have to go to the Olympics.
Yeah, there's a bit of that.
Come on, buddy.
Bit of that. Yeah. Those thigh muscles are a very different muscle to the calf, which acts as a pump, I believe, to the lower, to the feet and the toes. So the action of that is, makes sense that you can go further for longer, I guess, with those stronger thigh muscles.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that the basic application, I was chatting to Rex once about, you know, how do they decide what needs best? How do they design the running blade? Why isn't there something a little bit more conventional looking? Like, why is it a J? Basically the opposite of what a leg looks like. And they said, basically we look at a limb, a real limb. We find out where the amputation would be and we find out what would be the best way to make that replicate walking, running, jogging, things like that. That's the basic application. And people come together with all these different designs, which they've been paid to research and, you know, whack it on. And it's just incredible stuff.
Wow.
Mm.
We are speaking with Sam Bramman. He is the author of a book titled Three Quarter Man. And it's byline is Pranks, Passion and Paralympics. When we come back, we'll find out exactly what Paralympics he's been in. And he's been in a few. You are listening to Word for Word right across Australia on the Community Radio Network.
Hi, this is Rachel Berger, and if you're not listening word for word, then you're not listening to Dean Beck on Joy 94.9, and you're missing out.
You are listening to Word for Word across Australia on the Community Radio Network. We're speaking with Sam Bramman. He is the three-quarter man, as the title of his book says. Is that a title, that a saying that you've always gone with, the three-quarter man, or was that your editor stepped in and said that?
No, actually, I had different titles in mind, but this one, so where the three-quarter man comes from, in my category, so in disability sport, all disabilities are sort of placed into categories. So all the paraplegics with the paraplegics, the vision impaired with the vision impaired, cerebral palsy with cerebral palsy, and of course amputees with amputees. So I'm in...
Are there then grades within those divisions?
Sort of, but over the same sort of scale. So it goes from S1 to S14, S1 being the most severe disability, to S14 being the least. S14 is someone with a mild brain injury, intellectual disability. That's anyone with the IQ under the IQ of 75, which on some Friday and Saturday nights I qualify for. And S1, no, you're allowed to laugh. You've got a green card. You're in a room with a person with a disability. S1 is...
but you've only got one leg missing.
Just the same. So S1 is someone, you know, quadriplegic with very limited movement. There are no S1s in sort of, hardly any, I should say, in the sort of Western civilization, but a lot in sort of poorer countries, second, mm-hmm. third world countries, because they don't have the medical facilities to stop a disability from deteriorating or to support. So my category, S9, that's anyone with half an arm or half a leg. So we compete against each other.
But as you found out in one of your meets, you were beaten by someone who basically had the same condition as you, weren't you? But hadn't had the foot taken off.
Yeah, so Jesus Collado, who was my main competitor from Spain, he was born with the exact same condition that I was, but he kept his foot. He didn't amputate it. So that acted as a little bit of a flipper. I'm just making excuses, but definitely would have helped. So we call each other, there's a running joke around the world, we call each other three-quarter men because we're three-quarters finished. Mm-hmm. We're missing but one of our limbs. Then the idea with the book is, and what I teach in my public speaking and to youth and to, you know, businesses and council, wherever I speak to, is that you should always look at life as three-quarters finished. You should never be finished. There almost must be something to do. So there's a big metaphorical sort of thing behind the title, which is, of course, drafted from being an S9 three-quarter man.
And if someone had their leg blown off in Iraq, would they potentially be an S9 too?
Could be, depending how high up. Sure, so this is where the scale is. If you're missing your whole limb...
But it's not a case of whether you were born with it or not, or anything like that.
No, right, okay. No, absolutely not. So it's basically how much you're missing. So S9 is anyone with half an arm, half a leg, and S8 would be someone missing a whole limb, for example, or two half a limbs on different limbs. S7 would be mild cerebral palsy, S6 intense severe cerebral palsy, S5 paraplegics, and then keeps going down from there.
Sam Bramman competed in the Athens Paralympics and won in 2004, won a gold and a silver and a bronze medal. He competed here in Melbourne at the Commonwealth Games in 2006 and in 2008 at the Beijing Paralympics, where he won a gold and a silver. Somewhere in the middle of that, you got an Order of Australia medal.
Yeah, and that was probably the biggest shock. This letter came in, this is 2009, so just after Beijing. I'd called my first retirement then. I just came back from an overseas trip with some friends and really loving sort of my post-career. Spending more time with mum and dad, more time with the family, enrolled at university finally, so catching up with my friends, where they were educationally-wise and professionally. Then I get this letter, this government official letter, and I thought, shit, here it is. You know, this is, you know, my first ever sort of government sort of inquest into what my bad behaviours entailed, or what have I done. So I started retracing my steps. Shit, where have I fucked it up? I opened it up and it said, you know, you've been awarded the OIM. We'd like you to come to this event and accept it. And then when I read the list, so they released in the newspaper all the people's names who were receiving it, and all there was police officers and firemen and, you know, people that are actually putting their lives on at risk at every day. So to feel that, just to be next to these guys, not that it's the same work, but to be next to these guys was such a great honour. And it was actually for, I later found out, not for good behaviour or anything like that. It was for number one service.
Clearly.
Yeah. Well, services to the country through sport. I got that. But it was also for acting as a role model to my younger teammates. By me acting like an idiot or being funny or whatever, took their mind off the stresses.
So do you know who nominated you?
There was four. There was a group of four younger ones, which I believe who were them, and whoever else there must have just kept backing. But
And you would have to be one of the youngest recipients of the Order of Australia Medal, I would say.
I'm actually not too sure.
I reckon you are.
Look, it's a great honour.
It is indeed.
I'm just worried like, that I'll lose it. I'm trying to hold on to it as best I can.
Now, you, was it the Athens Paralympics that you almost caused an international incident?
Yes. So my first Paralympics,
This is quite extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, it was my first sort of international experience. My second, actually, the biggest being at Athens. And I'd broken the world record in the heats and swam slower in the final. So I was kind of confused, but grabbed the bronze medal. I was happy that I grabbed the bronze, but confused as to, you know, why didn't I get that gold when I should have? Like the times that were swam were, you know, swam was the fastest. Anyway, went to the media pit, and there was this American journalist. I'm trying to answer these questions, you know, what happened, and there's this American journalist at the back going, what happened to your leg? What happened to your leg? Just wanted to know about the leg. So I thought, all right, I need some cheering up, come over here. He said, so what happened to your leg? I said, oh, I was on a camping trip with mum and dad when I was about 5. They put me asleep in the tent. We're in the outback, put me asleep in the tent. They went off and partied. Some kangaroos came in and gnawed my leg off. Thinking he'd just laugh, you know, oh, yeah, bullshit. Anyway, he goes, no, kangaroos don't do that. And I thought, God, this guy's like half for real. I said, no, they don't eat meat. They just attack humans. They're really vicious. And he goes, no, I've been to the Australia Zoo and I've patted them. I've said, mate, pat the ones in the zoo all you want. They're drugged. They're sedated. If you see one in the wild, you have to run as fast as you can. And he goes, you serious? I said, yeah. And he goes, can I put this in my newspaper? I should have said no. I said, yeah, go for it. Anyway, I came back from Athens and I got called into the Swimming Australia office and
Weren't happy, were they?
Well, I didn't know what they wanted. At first, I thought, oh, great, you know, new swimsuit, new international trip. I get there, it's a Sunday, the receptionist is there, and they said, oh, they're up in the boardroom waiting for you. I said, oh, the boardroom, this is good, you know, what am I in for here? Went up the elevator, went into the boardroom. There's a big, long sort of room. There was these guys sitting around this table all in suits. There was a TV with a webcam on it at the end of the table. They're not saying a word. So I'm thinking, these guys want to make it like a weird film or something? Like, it's ominous in here, it's strange. Without saying a word, they throw this newspaper across the table. It says, Idaho News, Australia boy makes comeback after kangaroo attack. So got in a lot of trouble. I was banned from speaking to the media, American media, for 2 or 3 years, and I was fined a hefty sum as well.
You were fined as well?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. But it's the fun of having a disability. Have fun with it.
Well, we have seen some of our swimmers get into trouble for all sorts of things.
Yeah.
None leading journos astray. Sam, you're renowned for your practical jokes. Tell us some of the other things you've managed to get up to along the way.
Well, I've done a lot. It's something that keeps me, you know, keeps me busy when I'm away on trips as well. And when you're taken away on an international trip, there's so many rules and regulations and policies and guidelines you have to follow. You know, don't do this, don't do this, stay here, be here by this time. So that just frustrates me. But also by being locked in a room, my mind runs a million miles an hour and I think, you know, what's some fun I can have here to alleviate the boredom? It will start off with, you know, who can throw the tennis ball as close to the light without smashing it as possible. Of course, all the lights in the rooms are smashed. Who could, you know, hide each other's mobility aid for the most part or in the best? So I've done it.
Legs really went disappearing.
And for days.
Right.
For days on end, just because it's funny. My piece de resistance, my ultimate prank was, it was just before the Beijing Paralympics. And we just came back from the World Champs before going over there. We go up to the beach at the end of every year. We're sitting around the campsite. We're bored. What's some fun we're going to have? Straight away, you know, my friends and I, you know, the leg, you know, of course not. Like, why not use a leg? Let's play a shark attack prank. I thought, genius, why hasn't anyone heard of this before? So we went round to the local McDonald's, grabbed as many sauce sachets as we could, went round to the local beach. It was about a 30-degree day, light breeze coming through, wasn't too hot. There was 500 people on the beach itself, mums, dads, kids building sandcastles. Another 500 people in the beach, in the water itself, you know, surfboarders, boogie boarders, people splashing around. While all this is going on, we're behind these rocks undoing these sauce sachets one by one, giggling like little girls the whole time. Leg comes off, pour the sauce all over my stump, up the side of my body, replicating what we thought it would look like if someone were to be bitten by a shark. Our plan was, you know, we'd go out, I'd hang dead between them, they'd scream shark, we'd get a few screams, they'd realize it's a prank, we'd be the funny guys in town. Went ahead with our prank, my mate screamed out shark twice. Before they could scream out shark for like the third time, this ear-piercingly loud shark alarm went off on the beach. Now, if you can imagine what, like, 1,000 people doing total. When you hear like a shark alarm go off, people are jumping up, running into each other and falling down. Mothers are losing their bikinis because they were tanning with them untied. So we're getting a perv. My mates dropped me in the water. They bailed. I get back behind the rocks. I have to get up and hop as fast as I can as well because I didn't have my leg. There's a cop car hammering over the hill, followed by an ambulance, followed by a fire truck. I still don't know why he came along. Fell left out. Grabbed my leg, threw it straight back on, and just long story short, got grabbed by the cops. Spent the night in the cell. So 8 hours all up. Really? 7 nights in the cell. Then another hour in reception answering questions like, you know, do you love sharks? Do you hate the beach? Just trying to waste my time. But I said, you know, how'd you find me? That was the thing rattling around in my head. How'd you find me? And he said, it wasn't too hard looking for a one-legged dickhead that saw himself running through our small town. So I was busted. But again, that's the fun you can have with disability. And there'll be more to come.
Sam, when you won your medals in Athens, tell us what that feeling was like the first time you won gold and silver and bronze.
Mm.
Well, bronze was a bit of a
interesting sort of background.
Downer, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it was
considering you'd just broken the world record.
Well, that's what was confusing for me. And I was young. I didn't really know how to handle my emotions at that, because you're under so much pressure. Your KPIs are to win gold medals, be the best. And when I knew that I could have had it so easily, I didn't know why I didn't do it. I found out 2 years later why. It was just because I got distracted and didn't soak up any of the atmosphere. I was thinking about a gold medal that I didn't even have, rather than my race plan. What should I be doing, you know? But the other two medals, even the bronze, when I walked out to get that bronze medal, once I got up on the dais and I saw the Australian flag get lower behind me, see the team, see mum and dad, you know, how proud they were, that's when it hit home. Look, I've just achieved something pretty great. Mm-hmm. The gold and silver more so, because I did it with three other men. We did it together. Swimming, it's more of an individual sport. So to sort of revel in that together, you know, we're hugging each other, slapping each other on the ass, and like just exuding so much energy. It was just so much fun. Yeah. And to get up on the block with these guys, and especially the goal when we heard the Australian anthem, it was emotional. We all started crying. Like, it's, you know, you've done this for the country. It's no longer just for yourself. It's an amazing, amazing experience.
The Paralympics has really been embraced in the last sort of 10 years or so. And what's the turnaround, do you think?
I think in disregard any sort of media attention which we do or don't receive, I just think Australians like to see Aussies do well, rather regards of what the sporting code, whether it's male, female sport, disabled, able-bodied sport. It doesn't matter. If there's sport on TV, 80% of the population will get behind it and just be like, yes, go Aussies, let's see this happen. With the Paralympic sport, it's moving. It's building momentum and it's getting bigger, like a big snowball, more attention. And that was thanks to the Sydney Paralympics. They did such a good job there. The Athens Paralympics were great because it was back in Athens. So both the Paralympics and the Olympics got a lot of attention back to its starting roots. Beijing was spectacular because of how much effort what the Chinese did by these new infrastructures, the bubble, the bird's nest, beautiful things, which all eyes went on them for that infrastructure. So both received a lot of attention. London was spectacular. And we just saw, you know, the media getting behind them. So there was Paralympians getting interviewed. Mm. And even better, they showed a backstory about the Paralympian, which Olympians don't have, and that's their disability. And people want to know how they got to this stage. They think that they've had to overcome something. They want to know, well, how'd they lose their leg? How'd they become a paraplegic? What is their brain injury? What are their function abilities? And that's the interesting thing which able-bodies don't have.
And those stories are a little bit voyeuristic, but they're also about breaking down the stigma and getting an understanding and an appreciation.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And that was where it was extremely effective. It normalised disability completely.
That's it.
And look, that's the biggest barriers that people with disability face by getting into sport. Look, the cost barriers associated are immense. So it's not just going out and buying a pair of runners. You have to buy a $10,000 wheelchair if you need it. You have to buy a $14,000 running leg. You have to, you know, pay these fees. There's also transport barriers. Some people with disability can't drive because they're blind or they don't have the functionality to do it. But the biggest barrier, and this is the best thing about normalising it, is the attitudinal barriers. Whether it's on behalf of the person with disability, they're insecure, or people in public don't know how to handle someone with a disability. The biggest disability, you know, so if the public's approach to someone's disability was just that disability by itself and dropped all the other stuff with it, it'd be no more different than having a limp, than having a mild brain injury, or by having a mild blind side, or being deaf. Like, that's what it is. It's attitudinal barriers that are worse, and that's what need to be addressed with any group, whether it's, you know, gay and lesbian, whether it's disability, everything. The more we normalise things and create awareness. It just breaks down those barriers.
Dean Beck with you, and Sam Bramman is my guest in the studio, a champion, a Paralympic swimmer. I just realised in researching this story with you that there's no O in the Paralympic. It's not Paralympic.
Yeah, just Paralympic. So they've cut the O for some reason. Yes. O didn't make the cut. But para before Paralympics, and this is where the common misconception is, and I didn't know this until like 2 years ago as well. So
go on.
I'm not judging. So the para before Paralympics, the normal sort of conception is that it means paralyzed or paraplegic. Para.
All right, yep.
It actually means parallel in the sense that we run parallel with the Olympic Committee. Yep. We go to the same country. We utilize the same facilities, the same food hall, the same sponsors. The only difference is we have a few modified sports, which the Olympics don't have, such as you know, wheelchair tennis, wheelchair rugby. By the way, if you can get to some Paralympic sport, go see wheelchair rugby. It is the most insane thing you'll ever see. It's called murder ball for a reason. These guys can't tackle conventionally, like, you know, grab into each other and pull each other down. They have to ram their wheelchairs. So these 25-30 km an hour, and that's how much speed these guys get. When I was in Athens, I went across to see Germany and Russia play each other. I saw one guy come out in a wheelchair. One of the spokes broke out of the wheels, went through his quad, because he couldn't feel his quad because he was a complete para. He just pulled the spoke out, got back in his chair, kept playing. Crazy stuff.
Sam, I'm going to pick you up on something here. On the front of your website, it says that you tried from swimming to a shoulder injury. And then when you delve a little deeper into your website, it says that that's all a load of crap and that you're just bored witless.
Well, the shoulder injury... No, you're not. You're half right, half wrong. The shoulder injury, that happens. That developed over my swimming career, and that was with butterfly. You are abusing your shoulders to pull your body through at that speed, at that high intensity, and to do it so much, you do. And because with me, because I don't have my... I take my leg off to swim. With my dolphin kick, there's a discrepancy on the right side of my body where I actually have to overcompensate with the left to lean over and pull harder. So... Sure. The shoulder was overdeveloping. There was a small tear in my subscap first. What their plan was, because it was only a small tear and that I only had a few years left in my swimming, what the medical team said, oh, we'll just inject you with cortisone, a numbing agent. Because if you have surgery, you'll be out of the pool for months and you might miss this competition, this gold medal. So, no, you
may not be right either.
Wasn't right. It was just, it was a complete mismanagement on my, because I was an adult by then too. I could have made the decision to have surgery. Yeah. But they were the ones pushing for, no, let's inject. So that's what happened. And because I couldn't feel the pain, the tear was getting bigger and bigger and bigger, complete tear. So the shoulder, I wasn't coming over as far as I used to, and I wasn't competitive anymore. So that really screwed me towards the end. And that was, 2012. But I did retire earlier on before that, after Beijing, because I was bored, completely bored. I just felt like I'd run the course. I wasn't getting satisfied as much as I used to, and called it quits.
But something happened, and one is a new sport, which I can see how you can be drawn to that as being want to get in on the ground level, I guess, and something that you can manage to do reasonably well with a bit of tweaking. But what is it that really got you back into training and wanting to set your sight on Rio?
Well, once I retired after Beijing, I came back and gave the swimming thing another crack. And that was after a few years. And what happened was I was loving the uni, loving the work, loving the social life as well. But I felt like there was something more to do. I wasn't happy with how I left my my swimming career. So there's a bunch of different factors. And it was actually with Ron Barassi, football champion. And I was telling him how I feel. And he said, ah, I know exactly what you mean. I had the same thing at your age. You've got that tickle in your balls.
Thanks, Ron.
Yeah, we're at like a carbine lunch as well, so it's really nice. And I was taking it back, and for me, it takes a lot, but it was Ron Barassi saying the word balls that really sort of threw me, but I thought, no, I don't have a tickle in my balls, but I know what you're getting at. I do feel unsettled. I need to do something. So I gave swimming another crack, but not the full hog, but... So I retired again after London, and that was it, completely it, with swimming anyway. And it's only been the last 2 years that I've thought, no, look, I want to do something. This new sport drew me in, paratriathlon. It's freestyle, not butterfly. So
I was going to ask you about that. It's not your favourite stroke, is it?
No, not at all. So it's freestyle for 950 metres in open water, which is totally different from an Olympic pool. Then it's a 20K bike ride, which I can't stand bike riding. Why is that? Well, number one, if you've got a car, use it. I'm just that lazy. number two, which is the wrong message, but number two, I don't like myself in Lycra, so I don't fit into the whole bicycle culture.
You spend half your life in Lycra.
Well, in the pool, where it's like submerged, but you're going out into the public, like you're, and like where you can see things just rumbling around on the seat and like big bums, and I just look awkward in Lycra. So there's that, and I just find it so tedious, like, you know, that repetition, and I don't get the enjoyment out of it, which a lot of people do, which I understand that. So I need to get my head around that. It's a mental application, mental application to enjoy the riding. The running I love. I just put the iPod in and just go for a run. And because I've only found running in the past 3 years, I never could run. So it's a new thing for me and I'm loving it.
So how do you wear that limb when you're running or a different one?
Different one. Right. I'll do the swim. Someone will help me up to the water. I'll hop along the sand, jump in,
swim. You do the swim without it?
Swim without it.
Yeah.
When I come back into the sand, I'll hop up onto the sand. I'll have my bike leg there ready to go. I'll grab my bike leg, throw it straight back on.
Now, is that totally engineered just for bicycling?
Not really. I was, because it is quite expensive. You can get one,
yeah.
But I just forked out a lot of money for the running leg. So I use an old leg, and we made a few modifications to it so the foot at the bottom could pivot round with the bike pedal.
Yeah.
And that's what I use to get on. Then I'll do the 20K bike ride, come back in, get off the bike, and then throw the running blade on.
Right.
Mm.
So you've got to have everything lined up. And
ready to go.
You have your own support crew, or are they allocated for you?
I will for the summer season this year. Last year was the only season that I started getting into it, and I did it all by myself.
But at the Paralympics, when they have this event,
mm-hmm.
are you allowed to have your own team with you to do those changeovers, or are they marshals that are designated?
There would be supervised marshalling, but I'm not too sure. I guess what they do is you'll have someone that will set your leg up at each different point.
Right.
So there's that, but there will be marshals there making sure everything's running properly.
Yes. Is it exciting to have this included into the array of sports?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. It's a new sport. It's a new development for the Paralympic movement.
Are any of your contemporaries from way back when going to be a part of this?
There is. There's two.
Right.
So there's
okay.
an old competitor, Mark Barr from the USA, and him and I used to be head-to-head for most of our career until I started smashing him. No. it was very head-to-head. He retired for like 4 years and then has just recently jumped into paratriathlon. He's currently the champ, so in my category, which is try two, so it's no longer S9. That was just with the swimming.
Yeah.
So he's my main competitor and an old one. So it's going to be fun getting back in together and see if we can sort of punch each other along. Definitely.
Well, your biggest when is Rio?
Rio's 2016.
2016. So it really is head down, bum up, and make it happen now.
Absolutely.
And you're quite determined to make the cut.
I think I am. In Australia at the moment, I'm at the level where I'm going quite well. These next 2 years are going to be intense, just intense training, as you said, heads down, bum up, just go for it. So I've got high hopes to see what happens over there. If I do get over there, that's another story. Anything can happen, like it did in Athens for me.
Well, Sam Bremen, good luck, and thank you very much for sharing your story with us today. Good luck in Rio in 2016.
No, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it, Dean.
Sam's book is Three Quarter Man by Sam Bremen. It is by Affirm Press, and it's available out now in paperback from your favourite bookstore. There will be a podcast of this interview available for download from Joy's website, joy.org.au. And if you'd like to correspond with the program, we would love to hear from you. Send us an email, wordforword@joy.org.au. My name's Dean Beck. You can follow me on Twitter at Dean Beck On Air. And until next time, keep well, take care. Bye-bye.
Word for Word is presented by Dean Beck from Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, Melbourne's Joy 94.9. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations in the Community Radio Network.
To acknowledge the custodians of the land from which we broadcast, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and the Wadumatagal clan of the Darug Nation, and their elders past, present and emerging. We acknowledge and respect their continuing culture and the contribution they make to the life of this city and